Good morning. I guess I'm the last speaker before discussion, and just want to take an opportunity to thank Steve Hayward and Bill Campbell and Julie Flick and the team for putting on this amazing meeting. We needed this badly, I think, as a movement, and they did everything to make it work, including getting the name tags right, which I personally was very grateful for, because I was in a meeting recently, and everybody was being so friendly. They were coming up and smiling, and I realized that the computer had shortened my affiliation, and my name tag simply read, Ken Cribb, Intercollegiate Stud. As Bill Campbell said, 3 years ago, these ex-presidents stood before you to address the theme, Where in the World Are We Going? April 2006, we were riding high politically, Republicans in control of the elected branches of government, strong in the states. But beneath the surface, we knew quite well at that meeting that things were not well, that we were ill at ease. The movement was being buffeted by centrifugal forces, mostly having to do with foreign policy, threatening our hard-won unity. In my own remarks then, I briefly surveyed our common history as a movement, pointing out the flashpoints of principled difference between the traditionalist libertarians and the anti-communists, as Klaus did, but then also showing the intricate web of common ground, not just prudential arrangements, but principled common ground that also connected those strands. We were more than a marriage of convenience, more than a coalition of expediency. And I think, in fact, the hard work that was done by some very serious intellectuals to bring those strands together, not merely for prudential reasons, but because they were different aspects of the same reality, that's the way Meyer talked about it, was a true thing. And what John said was true when he said that in great part what our movement represents is what already exists in the communities and in the neighborhoods. Wilmore Kendall said it this way. He said, it's what Americans know in their hips. It's what they know in their hips. So today the circumstances we face politically are quite different. Republicans have lost control of both houses of Congress, lost the White House, weakened in the states. President Obama is the most left-wing president in the history of the United States. He is at least superficially popular as celebrity in chief. The economic crisis on which he has come to office is arguably the most severe since the Great Depression, and he has responded as a perfect Keynesian with a fantastical growth of government reach and power. I take it back, not a perfect Keynesian, because even Lord Keynes knew better than to raise taxes into a recession. But at every turn, we face emboldened liberal voices crafting a narrative of conservative overreach in the Bush years, setting the stage for a massive shift leftward of the American political and cultural spectrum. And empowered by this narrative, the left has set out to overturn the work of decades, not only in economics, but in foreign policy and in the moral cultural sphere as well. Responsible conservatives recognize that under these circumstances especially, we do not have the luxury of squabbling. We must hang together. And happily, there is more than pragmatic reasons to do so, although that is its own reason. We are compelled to a renewed unity by a new centripetal force in our midst, and that is the revival of socialism. The wheel has come full circle. The first stirrings of what would become the American conservative movement began with opposition to the New Deal. Those early individualists that had been mentioned, Chodorov, Nock, saw clearly that government can never be a producer of wealth, only a redistributor and a consumer. And then Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises recognized that state intervention warps the price mechanism, creates political uncertainties about the future which bring investments to a halt. Does sound familiar? Moreover, a money supply under political control introduces well-nigh irresistible pressures for ultimately inflationary spirals. All true, But at the same time, the traditionalists were reacting to socialism. Richard Weaver saw in socialism the undermining of the virtues associated with property, the undermining, too, of those local communities of memory and of mutual aid that structure our social responsibilities in a truly humane way. And while some now thoughtlessly condemn the Southern agrarians as anti-capitalists, it should be remembered that the original working title of I'll Take My Stand was Tracts Against Communism. The anti-communists, like James Burnham, recognized in socialism the final triumph of the managerial revolution, as the buck stopped not with capital or the owner of capital or the voter, but rather with the expert bureaucrat, beholden to no one and nothing but his own expertise. The bright promise of socialism, so Burnham knew, always hides the reality of serfdom under the tutelage of bureaucratic masters. So it was these things in common that held our movement together at its birth, and they were just as true as the things that divided them, and one can emphasize either the one or the other, both are true. Insights regarding the socialist temptation that I've just discussed are just as true today as they were then, and they still remain a source of the deepest wellspring of contemporary conservative thought and action. The future of the conservative movement, therefore, will be to recall for us and for the countless others those earlier arguments, which are no less powerful and relevant today. As I will disagree with Charles Kessler and by quoting Samuel Johnson, men more frequently require to be reminded than informed. Reminding, and listen to the components of the words, it's not, and here I agree with Klaus, it is not enough to change laws, because laws can be changed back. Marginal tax rates lowered under Bush can be raised under Obama. No, our task is to change minds. And if this does not answer the question, Lenin's question, what is to be done, it does suggest where we must begin. We must begin again at the level of fundamental ideas that moved the generations to choose liberty over security, to choose the civic virtue over license, to choose the funded wisdom of mankind over the armed doctrines of ideology. But there is this little problem that Stan Evans pointed out in his remarks yesterday. The legions of red state young people that want to help haven't done the homework to be able to help. They haven't read the thinkers we've talked about all weekend, and they're innocent of the fundamental arguments they need in order to prevail. At ISI, we deal with elites. We try to help midwife the new intellectual leadership of each generation. But what about the scores of thousands of foot soldiers who will be needed for the political task at hand? In our own small way, ISI too is charging to the sound of the guns, because beyond our direct work with young intellectuals, we built a new suite of internet websites that together we call the American Ideals and Institutions Resource Center. But at the heart of this technology are six short courses: Western Civilization, The American Experience, Free Markets and Civil Society, American Security, The Conservative Intellectual Revival, Higher Education, Liberal Arts. They're short courses, but they hyperlink to literally hundreds of one of the seminal works of the mind that together form the kind of education that will be required if we are once again to seize the high ground. The bad news is that this takes time. The good news is it's the only thing that works. So beyond what we are doing, all of us together in this room, as we survey the political situation, already there's some signs of a thaw. Typical for a man of the left, Obama is not a serious student of history. He's interpreted 2008 as a simple repeat of 1929. He has presumed for himself the role of FDR in 1933. Evidently, in his first 100 days, his intention has been to set in motion a wholesale restructuring of the American society, to solidify a generation or more of failed and left-wing policies. But conservatives know that a true historical sense means more than dealing with facile analogies, as if history ever can simply repeat itself. A true historical sense also means more than extrapolating current trends in a straight path to the future. No, a true historical sense recognizes the uniqueness of each moment in history, discerning with as much learning as one can put together both the possibilities and the pitfalls that confront us. So Obama and his brain trust of new dealers lack that historical imagination, and they have failed to notice that their own election is far from a landslide of Rooseveltian proportions. Most of all, they fail to notice that the opposition they face does not consist of inarticulate businessmen and a handful of scattered intellectuals, as was the case in the 1930s, but rather consists of many major institutions that together constitute a true conservative movement, equipped with powerful arguments and a powerful voice. The work of a half century cannot be so easily brushed aside. This time, collectivist answers will not have room to run the field unopposed. And as a result, we're starting to see the amorphous thirst for change proclaimed in the election of Obama drying up in the land. Already, we see the deliberate sense of the American people begin to reassert itself. In the end, Americans do not want socialism, but they do want answers, and it is up to us to show the way. Yes, we have to do it all over again, but then we always have to do it all over again. In that sense, civilization is never more than a generation old. The defense of freedom is perennially necessary, and that necessity is born with the human condition itself. So if final success will always, in that sense, be just beyond our reach, it's the reaching that matters. It's time to get our hands dirty again. It's time to get to work. Thank you.